principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Dr. Sanford Lakoff is a political scientist at the University of California at San Diego. Dr. Lakoff is also a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, where he participates in a seminar entitled Energy and the Values of American Democracy, a qualitative investigation of energy, politics, and American culture. Dr. Lakoff was educated at Brandeis and Harvard Universities. He's the author of several books, including Science and the Nation and Equality in Political Philosophy. Dr. Lakoff has also written articles about government, ethics, and science. In a previous edition of Soundings, the radio program of the National Humanities Center, Dr. Lakoff discussed the energy crisis and American values. Soundings now continues that examination with regard to the effects of the energy problems on American life. John Agresto, a member of the staff at the center, begins the discussion.
Professor Lakoff, given the energy crisis, supposing it gets more severe, what could be the worst possible scenario that we can envision?
I suppose that the worst possible scenario would be that we would remain as dependent or become even more dependent on foreign supplies. And because of the instability of conditions in the Middle East, these supplies would be jeopardized or cut off. We would not have had enough time, I'm assuming, to convert to other resources or to considerably increase our efficiency in the use of energy. If that were to happen, I think we could easily anticipate tremendous conflicts over the allocation of these scarce resources. In addition, I think we would face a very serious problem of war. Because even a couple of years ago, Dr. Kissinger said that while we would try to accommodate the needs of the oil suppliers, if we ever faced a situation where the West was being strangled, we might well have to consider going to war. Well, if not only our access to oil were cut off, but that of Japan, which depends on imports for something like 90% of its energy needs, and of Western Europe, if the Soviets were to intervene not just in Afghanistan, but in Iran and more directly in Iraq and so on, well, one can easily perceive that the energy situation would deteriorate to such a point, not only that we would have internal difficulties, but that there might well be a major war that we would be involved in.
Let's reverse the question. Let's be highly speculative in this. What would happen if tomorrow we woke up and discovered an abundant, cheap, inexhaustible supply of energy? What would happen not only in international affairs and in political affairs, what would happen to us, our character, our way of life, our outlook?
Well, I think to some extent we would revert to business as usual. We would again become used to cheap supplies of energy, and we would carry on as we did before 1973. We would again take energy supplies for granted. We might not feel that we needed to restrict our consumption. We might feel, again, as expansive as we used to be. But I think we want to bear in mind that there are difficulties even with that. Bear in mind, first of all, that the energy problem is not just an American problem, it's a world problem. And something depends on whether these inexhaustible supplies are available not just to us, but to other countries. And a lot depends on whether those countries can afford the inexhaustible sources. It depends on the price, in other words, that would have to be paid. I think that that's a very utopian suggestion. Utopian in the sense that it's most unlikely that we could even begin to think about inexhaustible sources of energy before 30 years from now.
Professor Lakoff, right now we're living in a seller's market, and particularly the countries of the Middle East are enjoying reaping enormous profits. What's going to happen if and when the scenario that John has asked you to describe comes to pass, or if and when we get to the point that we are relatively self-sufficient? Is it going to be time to be mean to the Middle East?
Well, I suppose that one could argue that by that time, if it's going to take 20 to 30 years, the Middle Eastern nations will have such a stake in our economies that if we're mean to them, we're mean to ourselves. One must realize the amount of capital that is flowing now to the oil-producing states, and those petrodollars are being recycled, as we say, in the sense that they are winding up with equity holdings in the Western countries. So I think a form of interdependence is being developed which will preclude any effort on our part to punish anybody. Their resources will have been invested in our companies.
Professor Lakoff, I think many Americans feel the energy crisis as sort of a moral shock. We've always prided ourselves on our technology and prided ourselves in our belief in progress, and we're a little, in a sense, scandalized, might be too strong a word, but I think we're put off by the fact that we have not yet solved this by the tried and true American methods. Any comments on that?
Yeah. Well, frankly, I think we should feel it not as a moral shock exactly, but as a shock to our lack of foresight. We really didn't anticipate that we might ever become this dependent, and there was no good reason not to anticipate it. There were far-sighted oil geologists, for example, who pointed out that oil supplies were dwindling. There were others who recognized that the oil-supplying nations could be put in a position of forming a cartel. And we carried on without worrying at all about what the future would hold. I think we've got to get over that. We've got to start thinking in terms of at least the short-run future, 5 or 10 years, and making up our minds as a country that we have to do things about those shortages.
Let's talk for a second, Professor Lakoff, about the topic of conservation. How effective is it? What in it is effective? What are its virtues and what are its liabilities?
That issue has become somewhat muddied, and I think the authors of the Harvard study, for example, on energy, have done something useful in trying to emphasize that when you talk about conservation, you're not simply talking about cutting back on consumption. The most important form of conservation is improving energy efficiency. It is carefully estimated by engineers and economists that we could maintain something like an average 3% rate of economic growth using a relatively stable amount of energy. In other words, by continuing to improve the efficiency with which we use energy, we could maintain economic growth. That's the crucial thing. And it means, for example, that when you produce steel or when you produce automobiles, you simply do so with factors other than energy. You get more use out of the energy that you put in. And that is the best form of conservation, because it means that you don't have cutbacks in productivity. You don't have to endure sacrifices. You simply make more efficient use of energy. For instance, if you have refrigerators, to take a homey example, in the past we never bothered about the efficiency of the refrigerators in using energy. Now there are ratings that you see when you buy a refrigerator as to how much energy this particular unit will cause. And you can get the same degree of refrigeration, the same benefits, but what you do is you make sure that you build in whatever technology is necessary to improve the efficiency. Now, what's done for refrigerators can be done on a scale that saves a great deal more energy by industry.
Professor Lakoff, you have talked about transportation and mass transportation. Is the energy crisis as we know it now likely to affect what America does, America's policy about mass transportation?
Yes and no. I think it's clear that we wish we could have systems of mass transportation and that we wish we could substitute them for the private automobile. I'm afraid that we are very limited in what we can do, as, for example, the experience with the BART system in San Francisco indicates. The BART system involved a tremendous investment of money, and so far it has not lived up to expectations in the sense that it hasn't drawn off enough ridership. And one of the reasons for that is simply that our residential and work patterns have become so dispersed that it's a great inconvenience for us to have to rely on mass transit. If you compare what's going on in the cities of the West with, say, a city like Toronto, which has a remarkably good mass transit system, the biggest difference is that a city like Toronto has greater density than, say, Los Angeles or even the San Francisco Bay Area, and so it's easier to afford systems of mass transit. But there's also another reason. Toronto has a system of metropolitan government, so that there is a unit that can actually plan the kind of housing that is built in the suburbs, so that instead of having single detached houses spread all over the landscape, in Toronto the suburbs have high-rise apartment buildings built in anticipation that a subway line would be built out to them. And so you have the possibility of a more efficient use of mass transit. That doesn't mean, however, that we can't get away from very capital-intensive forms of mass transit and inflexible forms and do more with buses, for example, or, as in San Diego, with a Tijuana trolley, a light rail system that will go from the border directly into San Diego using an existing right-of-way, a railroad right-of-way, very inexpensive form of mass transit.
Sounds to me, Professor Lakoff, as though you're saying that our cherished American notion of individualism is coming back to haunt us in the form of this energy crisis. Is that true?
Yes. I have to agree with that. I think that the pattern of residential dispersion, the mobility that's been characteristic of American society, has been a mixture of an intense individualism coupled with the availability of income and energy resources. And one answer to the problem that we face is to move in a more communitarian direction, to think rather of cluster zoning, for example, in which you blend homes, or to think in terms of condominiums in which you share facilities, rather than the single-family suburban house as the ultimate ideal. I myself don't find that so terrifying, because I think cities are great things. I find suburbs rather dull. But I know that other Americans value the ability to live in a single family house, and they think that that's part of their freedom. I hope that we can keep that option open, even as we rediscover the joys of inner city living. My ideal, and I think it's the ideal of most Americans, would be a mixture of individualism and community.
Professor Lakoff, in almost all your answers, I detect a certain tone. And the tone goes something like this. The energy crisis is a mixed evil. That there is, in a sense, something to be learned from this, maybe even something beneficial from it. If you had to pick the one good thing that might come out of this energy crisis, what might you pick?
I'm glad you put it that way, because I think you're right. I think I see it almost the way Toynbee saw the issue of challenge and response. And remember that his analysis of the American character depended on the fact that the American experience at the beginning was an experience of a hard and rock-bound coast. It was not a soft environment. It was one that challenged us to develop certain virtues that made the great prosperity of this country possible. I think that if we respond properly to the energy problem, we can renew our sense of values, we can renew a sense of community, we can overcome some of the tendency toward ignorance, indifference, social irresponsibility that does develop when you have a long period of affluence and when it seems as though it's automatic and nobody has to worry about it and nobody has to think about the future and nobody has to worry about national policy. And so you get the phenomenon that I think we've been experiencing too much in recent years, of a withdrawal from politics, of a sense of blaming it on the oil companies or on the bureaucrats or whoever. I think if the energy problem succeeds in sobering us up and getting us to rethink our values, in to adjust our behavior more rationally, to and above all to develop a sense of citizenship, to recognize that we're all in this together and that we all have some responsibilities, then it could be a real blessing.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Dr. Sanford Lakoff teaches political science at the University of California at San Diego. Dr. Lakoff is also a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, where he's a member of a seminar entitled Energy and the Values of American Democracy, a qualitative examination of energy, politics, and culture. This edition of Soundings continues a previous discussion with Dr. Lakoff about the impact of the energy problem on American life. Joining in the conversation is John Agresto, a member of the staff at the center. Professor Lakoff, you have talked about democratic societies rising to the challenge and the peculiar relationship of a democracy to the kind of problem that we have with the energy crisis. In practical terms, how will, in your view, how will the energy crisis affect American politics? Obviously, it's an issue in when election time comes around.
Well, let's look at the way it has affected it so far. First of all, in the recent past, energy was a problem that we looked at in terms of different sectors. There was the coal problem, the oil problem, natural gas, atomic energy, and this was reflected in our approach in government. Each of these separate sectors had its own iron triangle, its own network of bureaucrats, legislators, and pressure groups. People as a whole did not think of energy in any comprehensive term. That, it seems to me, is why it was important for us to have an Energy Act, why it was important to set up a Department of Energy. Now, I don't mean to say that that's the only way to approach the problem, but it does suggest that as a country we have overcome our tendency to think of the energy problem in separate, well-cordoned off areas, and to try to develop a more coherent approach to it. And that's the first thing I would mention. The second thing, and it's much more negative, is that the energy problem has released certain tensions. It's given an added boost to a feeling of insecurity with government and experts. And you see that in the great fears unleashed, for example, by Three Mile Island. You see it in the uncertainty about whether to proceed with nuclear power. Furthermore, it seems to me you see it in possible rent strikes in New York because of energy shortages. There are a host of ways in which the energy problem has made social life more difficult in America and therefore made political life more difficult. But the one good thing I suppose you could say is that the more the energy problem has entered into the normal activities of the political system, the more people are aware of what the problem is, the more they choose what to do about it. In the last election, for example, we did have a sort of debate over an oil tax, over whether there should be a 50-cent tax on oil. The American people, one might argue, voted against that notion. They voted in favor of a candidate who argued that what we needed to do was to unleash the private sector to discover more oil, to use more coal, etc. Well, we're now going to have a trial of that policy to some extent. If it doesn't work, then we may be sure that people will say, we've got to try something new. In short, the energy problem has been politicized. It's entered into the net of issues that come up in election campaigns that affect public opinion. And I like that better than a situation in which we sort of strike out blindly and we deny that there is a problem, or we try to blame the oil companies or what have you.
Professor Lakoff, let's talk for a second about the poorer countries in the world. What should the American policy be towards the poor countries, given the energy crisis and the the way in which it affects them so severely too?
First of all, I think we can take a narrow position of saying, let's worry about our own energy independence. But if we do that, we are courting really serious problems in our international relations. And I don't mean only that more countries will be inclined to move into the Soviet orbit. I do mean that there will be very serious economic problems in many developing countries, which will affect us, because we are dependent not just on imported oil. We're dependent on imported raw materials from many other countries, some of which are very poor countries. And if, for example, poor countries, because of the rising prices of oil, are forced to strip more and more of the trees in their forests, which they are doing now in very dangerous proportions, then it means that they'll suffer soil erosion. Eventually, it'll affect their ability to feed themselves. There will be starvation in many of those countries, and tremendous pressures on the governments that they have, which could result in more Ugandas, more countries which are just reduced to such a margin of poverty that they can't produce or export anything. That is not in our interest. You might argue, too, that many of them will become desperate and go to war, and that as there is nuclear proliferation, the danger is that there will be nuclear wars and that we will be dragged into those nuclear wars. In general, it's a very bad situation. It's also a factor that the group of 77, so-called, in the United Nations, which comprises not just the poorest countries of the world, but even those developing countries which have major resources, the OPEC countries, are often united in opposition to American interests. And furthermore, that they are making demands for a new international economic order, which we find unacceptable, because they would require a redistribution of wealth, they would require political interference with economic transactions, and so on. So our response to the needs of the poorer countries, it seems to me, has to be one that won't satisfy that kind of radical demand. But it would be a great mistake if we were not to take the needs of the developing countries into account in developing our own energy policy for the reasons I've alluded to. What does it mean to take them into account? Well, for one thing, it means that we must be careful about using so much oil that we drive up world prices even further and make it impossible for developing countries to afford fertilizer, just to give a simple illustration. Secondly, it may well mean that we have to develop our coal resources in such a way that we can put them more into the world market so that, again, there will be alternate sources for oil. Finally, it means that we have to share our technology, our capital, our know-how with the developing countries much more actively than we have so far done, to help them to develop what is called appropriate technology given their own situation, their own needs. I don't think that we can safely adopt a national energy policy that excludes the needs of the developing countries.
Professor Lakoff, what is that going to do to relations between and among countries of the world?
Well, this is a paradox. People have sometimes argued that because of the energy shortage, and because of the population problem, because of the resource shortage, inevitably we are going to become a more interdependent world system. Spaceship Earth, one globe, one planet, all citizens of it, and so on. Well, it's a glorious image, but I think we have to be realistic and we have to understand that in the short run, what the energy shortage has done is to exacerbate the sense of separateness, the sense of nationalism, the pursuit of national self-interest. The French are going ahead with nuclear policy, even though President Carter felt that it would produce a plutonium economy and that would risk further nuclear proliferation and the like. Curiously, there is more separatist sentiment in the world because of the availability of energy supplies. The Scots nationalists, for example, who for years had to rely on romantic notions, now say, well, we've got enough energy resources. Scottish nationalism is viable, if only we didn't have to share them with the English and the Welsh. Similarly, Quebec nationalism, separatism, is a much more viable proposition because of Quebec's energy resources. And Western Canadian separatism is being talked of for the same reason. So it's and then if you add what's going on in the Middle Eastern countries, the development in Iraq, for example, of a sense that oil resources make it possible to be a power, they make it possible to buy an awful lot of military technology, and once you have the military technology, you want to use it. The Shah's attempt to make Iran a great world power. All of these efforts were expressions of the availability of oil wealth, which did not produce a sense of interdependence, but on the contrary, a sense of now is our time to shine in the world, we can go it alone. And I think we have to recognize that. We have to recognize, therefore, that the problem of creating a sense of interdependence means that you have to overcome these tendencies toward separation, and you have to set an example for others by thinking in more global and long-range terms.
Professor Lakoff, I'd like to ask you to speculate a bit. Where is the world going to be in the year 2000?
I happen to believe very much in the important role of technology. I am not a technological optimist or a technological determinist, but I think it's a fact that in the 20th century especially, the world is experiencing the advent of what I would call scientific civilization, for better and for worse, to some extent. I therefore feel very strongly that we will manage to overcome many of our resource problems by the exercise of innovation, by the development of science and technology. I would not go so far, however, as to see this as a force for salvation. I think what we can be as easily victimized by it as we can be beneficiaries. We have to recognize, for example, that every time we develop a new technology, there are risks involved, and we may not even be conscious of what the risks are for quite a while after we use them. We now know, for example, that if we increase, let me put it this way, we think that if we greatly increase our dependence on coal, we may have a very serious problem because of the buildup of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And it's speculated that if that happens, there could be dramatic shifts in climate and therefore in agricultural zones in the world. Well, we don't want to commit ourselves to coal production, coal use, I should say, to such an extent that we run into an irreversible problem of that sort. Nevertheless, I think that if we're careful, if we use our ability to increase energy efficiency and to develop new technologies, we can be the masters of our own fate. We do not have to transform our society in ways that are uncongenial to us. I would anticipate, therefore, to answer your question a little boldly, that the America of the year 2000 will not be fundamentally different from the America that we know. Fundamentally in the sense that we will have to abandon our belief in liberty, our belief in human rights. On the contrary, I think that if we're prudent, we can enjoy the blessings of liberty in the same way that our forefathers have.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation, in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
This is Bill Bennett. Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. I'd like to invite you to listen to the Center's radio program, Soundings. This week, we're presenting a conversation about energy and American values with Professor Sanford Lakoff of the University of California at San Diego. The energy crunch isn't solely a question of dollars and barrels of oil. There are questions of quality of life and values at bottom of this issue. So join us this week for Soundings.